I'll tell you the germination of this panel. As Nomi has reiterated to me on several occasions now, this is all my fault. but the way I think it started was we discussed in the summertime. A few of us had several meetings, went on for hours about our goals of the year, our goals for the yeshiva, and what type of ideas we're trying to communicate. Which goals do we think we're meeting? It was quite a significant strategic planning meeting that went over several sessions. And in one of those sessions, one of the areas that we found was greatly lacking was in relating to issues of women today. I remember about a year ago, a year and a half ago, I guess it was, that Nomi and I were having a discussion about the remarks of one of her students. The one of her students said that most experiences that guys in yeshiva have with women, even women educators, women leaders, whatever the perspective is when they go to their rabbi's house for Shabbat and the women are working in the kitchen serving the food. And that's a shame, given the fact that the caliber of women that are out there today is quite stunning and intimidating and impressive. I just want to say that it cropped up in my mind that over the past number of years, in many areas, especially in the area of women in Talmud Torah, there's been nothing but a silent revolution that's gone on ever since the time of Chavetz Chaim and Crane Beis Yaakov's until today, where you can have advanced schools for women's Talmud Torah, be they in the United States or in especially in Israel, and having taught in one of those contexts, I thought it was only appropriate that we should relate to that. We discussed the Women's Yom Iyun Day. One of the things that we discussed was, okay, we'll discuss this issue and that issue, the other issue. It was brought up that anyone can teach can give a shiur, although I'm sure Aviad shiur was nothing but brilliant. But anyone, you know, it doesn't require women to give a shiur on women in Bikkur HaMazon or women in Kiddush or women in Zimun. That's not something which is unique. It was more interesting to bring in women who could talk about the uniqueness of their personal experience in coming to being involved in Talmud Torah in a very, very significant way, and women's leadership in a very important way. It's only, I guess, it's been mikra. It's only accidental that the three panelists are also spouses of faculty members at Eretz at Tzvi. That's not only because we could probably hop a Rhine and get them for cheap, given the fact that I speak Lindebaum all the time for free, despite the fact they deny it, but in any event, it's very exciting. What we thought about doing was we would have women, and it so happens that our faculty represent this, women from some slightly different periods of the development of women's studies, come and speak today. The first, of course, is, I mean, everyone's of course, but I'm going to introduce them anyway, just because it's necessary. But Mrs. Esther Krauss, who, as we all know, was the founding principal of Mayanot, which is a pioneer school in New Jersey, in women's single-sex institution of the highest caliber of both secular and women's studies. And I won't mention who they're married to because you'll know that, obviously. Ms. Dina Knoll, who's the most recent Laaretz, who is also the faculty Talmud chair at Mayanot. She's presently a Rambam Medrash at Lindenbaum, teaches at Nishmat, and it's a high school in Beit Shemesh. And also Mrs. Nomi Wather Berman, who with her husband was the founding director in the first Jewish Learning Initiative on campus at Brandeis University, a pioneer in that area, as well as Nomi has taught in almost every department of Dreschel Lindenbaum and served everything from Shana Bet, to Madricha, to Talmud, Halacha, and Tanakh faculties. So we're going to open up the panel discussion. I know there are a few questions were given in, but especially in light of things that happened earlier today, we're happy if you give appropriate questions in the duration. So I'll stop talking now. First, I'm sorry. First, you can introduce themselves a little bit more than I did, and talk a little bit about their advent to kind of their histories a little bit, their biographies a little bit, and their advent to the area of Talmud Torah.
Thank you, Rabbi Berman. First of all, this is nice to see how the other half lives. First, I wanted to really congratulate and tell you that you have a lot to appreciate being in this yeshiva, because I don't know that there are other yeshivot that, in fact, I'm sure there aren't very many, if any, who have the wisdom and, sadly, I have to say, the courage to address this kind of topic in an honest way. And that's because it really is a burning issue, and burning issues should not be swept under the rug, but should be addressed. I'll tell you a little bit about my background. I come as the senior person here, and I've probably seen the transition and experienced it in my own life. So I come from a soft Haredi background. What does soft Haredi mean? First of all, the term Haredi did not exist when I was growing up. But my father was a chassid, a Vishnitz chassid, and we would be considered today Haredim, although in many ways we were very different from Haredim today, because the world was very different at that time. But I grew up in a very traditional, in fact, European home, which added to the conservatism and the tradition. The place of women in that environment was very, very clear. I have three older brothers. I'm the only girl and the youngest. And just give you an example, Sukkot was not a very exciting chag for me, because we lived on the second floor in an apartment house, and the sukkah, the communal sukkah, was downstairs in the yard, and there was a pulley across the neighbors, a pulley that got the food from upstairs to downstairs. And guess who was downstairs and guess who was upstairs? So my mother and I basically spent the time in the kitchen, whereas my brothers were downstairs in the sukkah. I didn't question that. I wasn't happy about it, but I didn't think that there was any other possibility. I'm not going to go into further, but I just give you a sense of where I'm coming from. I attended Beis Yaakov, one of the only Beis Yaakov at that time in New York State, in New York, in fact, I think in the country. Beis Yaakov, elementary school, high school, and even teacher seminary, because I was told that and I was taught that the most practical thing for a woman to do was to teach. Since you're home from school, when your kids come home from school, you have summer vacations. When your kids have summer vacations, and even though I had this fantasy that I would like to be an anchor woman, that I'd like to be on Voice of America, that was obviously a fantasy. There was no way. The one thing that I did do, and because Beis Yaakov, unfortunately, was not an inspiring experience for me in terms of intellectually, in terms of learning, I did go to college, and that was quite revolutionary in the circles that I traveled in. It was a big concern that I would never get married because I went to college, but I did go to college, and was interested basically in the secular part of college and not in pursuing Judaic studies at that time. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time. I want to give the two women at my side an opportunity to give you their background. My evolution was very, very gradual, and it took me a very long time to be able to accept the fact that there were some things in Judaism that I was upset about, that were difficult, and that were not acceptable to me, and that there were ways in which those things could be addressed without throwing out the baby with the bathwater. It was a very long evolution, and I guess one of the reasons that I became involved in a very serious way, and certainly not under duress, but very happily, in women's education, it was because I wanted very much to be able to communicate that message to our students, and also to provide an atmosphere and an environment in which we would give the respect for women who have the intellectual, who certainly have the intellectual capacity, and give them an environment in which they could address these issues in a safe environment from people who were able to respond to them. I think that much of my philosophy in terms of education, I mean, some of it in any case, was definitely a response to my own education, but was also a response to what I felt were the continued needs of the Jewish community in terms of addressing women. I'm just going to conclude and then come out in questions and answers. I want to differ with Rabbi Berman when he said that we don't need women to give a shiur on women's issues. I think that
I was putting
notes. I think that it's very significant to have the input of a woman in terms of looking at the halachot and in terms of discussing the halachot, aside from the fact that you know, especially for girls, but I think for men as well, aside from the fact that for women, for girls, it also is, you're able to identify with a person, and the teacher is able to, and the students can identify with the struggle that the person herself might have. But further than that, I think that there is a sensitivity, and there's a different kind of look at what the objective halakha has to say, and I'm going to put that in quotation marks, the objective halakha, and that a shiur on women's issues by a woman might look very, very different than even brilliant shiur of In any case, I'll give the floor over to my friends here, and then we'll continue later.
Okay, first of all, I take full responsibility. I'll release that afterwards. We're progressing, I guess, somewhat generationally. Mrs. Krauss being one of the first role models for me. She was the assistant principal at Central when I was there. I think that I do not really reflect on feeling any restrictions when I was growing up. In retrospect, I realized that my family is sort of the inverse. I have an older brother and then two sisters. I guess in retrospect, I realized the expectations were different. My brother was expected to go with my father to shul on Shabbos morning on time or close to on time, and we could wander in sometime later. But I was certainly not conscious of it at the time. I think that the first moment of epiphany I can remember, which wasn't even negative, it was just the first time it had occurred to me that there was anything out there that I was not being exposed to. I went to Central, and in, I don't know, 10th or 11th grade, I had a Jewish history teacher who I very much admired. She was young and very energetic. And we were learning, I don't remember exactly what the particular class was on, we were learning Bayit Sheni material, and she decided to bring in a ketzah from Gemara, And she sort of made fun of herself and her inability to read the Gemara and said she had practiced with her husband the night before. And she stumbled her way through the piece of Gemara that she wanted to do with us. And at that point, I was totally oblivious that there was even an issue involved. But it was this moment of epiphany that I realized that I indeed hear Gemara quoted all the time, and I, like her, had not actually ever read Gemara. I didn't, in retrospect, this sounds really stupid, but I didn't know it was controversial at all. I just knew I'd never learned. I didn't know, my brother, I guess, was not particularly into learning. It's not like I saw him learning all the time and I wasn't. It just had never occurred to me before that I had never learned Gemara. So I went home that day and decided to take the Gemara off the shelf and start learning Gemara. And soon discovered that that wasn't going to be happening so easily. This was in the back of my mind. So the first opportunity I had afterwards, when I was in Stern, I decided to take an introduction to Gemara Shir and sort of figure out what that page was, because I didn't really know where the Gemara part was when I opened it myself. And that was really, again, so it didn't even come from a sense that anyone had told me I couldn't. I just realized at some point that I hadn't. And I guess that Gemara Shir is what led me to Lindemann, where I really started learning more Gemara more intensely. I guess somewhere along the line, maybe, I'm not even sure, somewhere along the line through the process of learning, then I discovered, I guess, that it was controversial from comments that people would make along the way. And it was only then that, I guess, in retrospect, I started to realize that it had been something that had intentionally been withheld from me, which I had not been conscious of at all. Just in terms of my going into education, unlike Mrs. Krauss, I was encouraged by my parents, who had both been involved in Jewish education, to do anything but Jewish education. And so I definitely was not, but unfortunately for me and my parents, I really liked learning, so it just sort of evolved from there. But during my years of learning, again, I was very much, I came totally out of a very innocent curiosity. And if you had asked me, like many students I have taught subsequently, I would have adamantly denied that I was a feminist. I just wanted to learn. Like, that was all. Don't bother me with anything else. And then at some point, I guess I had to concede that apparently that does render you a feminist. And if that is what makes you a feminist, then I guess I'd have to embrace that. I guess I just wanted to clarify why I am responsible for that line. I do agree with Mrs. Krauss that that there is, I think, a different perspective that women do bring to learning anything, probably, and particularly things that relate to women. I felt, though, that I was afraid that in the context of a Yom Yin, like coming in and giving a one-hour shiur, but it is something that, that as my husband quoted my students, I guess was something that I took for granted, and then I see that my students apparently don't, maybe because I didn't go to a co-ed school and many more of my students did, that all of a sudden it occurs to them at some point, wait a minute, do guys not have women teaching them when they're in yeshiva? And they're like shocked by this. And it's not necessarily something that I would advocate for a revolution in this area. But I do think that that especially since most of you have come from and will be going to places where women where women have educated you on many different fronts, that the particular the time in your life when you're most devoted to serious Talmud Torah study is the time in your life when women are most absent from your education, I do think sends a very subtle and perhaps unsettling message. So I think it is. Again, I want to second the kalah kavod to those who initiated, not only my husband, but others who initiated this this idea.
Hi, so I'm Dina Knoll. And it's interesting that even though younger than Nomi, that Nomi did not seem to have, like, almost been aware that it was controversial, whereas for me it was very clear to me from the get-go. From my family, from my parents, it was totally not an issue. Like, they would have been totally fine with me learning Gemara. They always encouraged me to do, like, whatever I wanted, basically, meaning in the sense of, if you're interested in learning X, then go learn X, whatever X would be. But schooling-wise, just by dint of where I lived, my teachers were always very yeshivish. I grew up in Highland Park, New Jersey. Don't know if anybody else did, but I went to RPRY. Don't know if anybody else. But anyway, just because of its proximity to Lakewood, virtually 100%, and maybe there was an exception or two along the way, but it might have even literally been 100%, of my teachers were from Lakewood, which I don't know if you're familiar, but it's a very yeshivish place where all the men learn in kollel and the women, I guess, support them by teaching, if you're like me. But anyway, so those were my role models of sort of like what it meant to be like a from person. Anyway, so I was definitely aware of the distinction between guys and girls in terms of learning, because starting from, I don't know, it was fifth grade or sixth grade, I think fifth, we had always been co-ed up until then. And then all of a sudden, the boys were like taken out because they started to learn Gemara, whereas the girls didn't. So it was like very clear. I mean, you sort of couldn't like miss that suddenly there was this like big difference going on. But the truth is, in that way, similar to Nomi, it didn't bother me in the sense of I wasn't angry about it. I was more just curious. Like, I very much wanted to know, so what is this Gemara thing that everybody's always talking about? So actually, for my bat mitzvah, I actually asked my parents if I could learn, like, sort of make a siyum on a masechet of Gemara for my bat mitzvah. And again, my parents were always totally fine with that. The distinction between guys and girls did not ever come from my parents. It was always from my teachers. So they were totally fine with it. And in fact, I did make a siyum on a masechet of Gemara for my bat mitzvah. But that was sort of the beginning and the end of it, because there wasn't really any way to sort of continue with it. Anyway, so sort of continued on, and I really had no experience with Gemara at all, except for just that sort of one brief time. And then I went to Berea after graduating from RPRY. And again, because of the proximity to Lakewood, most of the teachers were from Lakewood. So I did not learn Gemara through all of high school. And then the summer after I graduated high school, I attended the Drisha Summer High School Program. Again, don't know if you're familiar with Drisha, but it's a women's learning institution on the west side. Now I think it moved to the east side. It's in Manhattan. And that was my first real exposure to Gemara. And again, at that point, I'd already graduated 12th grade, so I was, I don't know, 17, 18, whatever, old. Meaning I was old enough to, like, appreciate. And it was literally, like, a life-changing summer for me. I mean, really, without exaggeration. I really felt this sense, and I actually have letters that I wrote that summer to my sister. And it really was. It was a totally, like, life-changing summer for me. Just in the sense of really feeling this sense of, like, oh my gosh, there's, like, this whole world of Judaism that I just didn't even know existed. And that suddenly I felt, like, was open. It was really, like, just a big deal. Anyway, but I went from then to my year in Israel, where I just didn't really have the chance to learn Gemara. But then when I got to CERN, I jumped sort of straight into it. I jumped straight into advanced Gemara, having no idea what I basically had 5 weeks of Gemara behind me. I was totally drowning. It took quite a while until I sort of, like, figured out what on earth was going on. But ultimately, I really loved it, and it really became, like, a huge part of my college experience. And then from there, I did the graduate program that CERN had just started. I was the first year of that program. And then straight from graduating from that program, I applied for teaching jobs, and Mrs. Krauss actually gave me my start. I started teaching in Mayanot, which really is a very remarkable place. It's really one of the few high schools that really do give women just equal access to all texts, and really encourages them to sort of, like, you know, there is no ceiling in terms of for a girls' high school. Right, there isn't. I don't know if there's any really others that do that. Certainly not in the New York area. Anyway, it was a fantastic experience for me, for learning, for just for everything. And ultimately, I even became the Talmud department chair at my unit, which was a far cry from the fact that I had never really learned Gemara when I graduated by the time I graduated high school. And then we just made Aliyah this past summer, and so now here I am teaching at Lindenham and whatever. So that's sort of a brief. That's it, I guess. There's questions.
We'll open with some of the questions that were given up to us before, and then I'm sure that based on just what they already said now, you probably have more questions based on that, so maybe I'll steal what it is. I'll just start with one of the first questions that I got. If the Gemara would be written today, would statements referring to women be different?
I think that the Gemara was, and the people who lived and spoke in the Gemara, who lived within a historic period and were influenced by the environment in which they lived, and could reflect on the reality of the environment in which they lived. On the other hand, they were interpreting Torah, and their interpretations of Torah may very well have been, were based on partially on the culture in which they lived. Anybody wants to add to that?
I agree. I can't imagine that it wouldn't have been different. Meaning, I think many, I would hope that the halakha probably would not be different, because again, there's an assumption about the Mesorah, but in terms of the more advice pieces or just statements about what they thought that aren't halakhic, I sort of can't imagine that they wouldn't have been different.
I primarily agree. I'll just add one caveat. I think that some of the statements, longer would take me to give an example. Some of the statements that I have encountered in Chazal that at first glance, I don't know, might be off-putting to me. On further reflection, I think I can relate to more. I think that sometimes it might be the way things are phrased rather than what they say that I think would be different. I think that also what when we say today, that's with today, I think there are many schools of thought in the development of feminist thought. Those that are much more see gender as a social construct, and those that see gender as still more of an innate construct. And hence, you know, do we look towards differences between men and women? And this is, I think, outside of our world of Torah and Halakha, is something which is very much still an open question. So it's no doubt that Chazal certainly relate to differences between men and women, and I think that there are certain voices today which would definitely be uncomfortable with the very notion of drawing such a dichotomy, and other voices today, feminist voices today, which would say, yes, of course there are innate differences between men and women, and those might have legal ramifications. I think even those would be articulated differently perhaps today, but I think it would still be something that...
I just want to add that I think that, yes, you don't have to deny the differences between men and women in order to say that the environment in which they lived would influence some of the dynamics. For example... For example, the economic structure, which made women totally dependent on men, would have to have an influence on some of the way in which, the famous Rav's Chazaka, that Tavla Meitav Tandu, that a woman would be rather marry anybody than not be married, is very difficult to defend today. I think, I'm not going to say it, but I'm thinking sometimes that it probably would be true the other way around. You see many more men who, after they lose their wives, marry very, very quickly, because it is very difficult for them to live alone. So I think that that's a sort of cultural influence.
One sec, that was exactly the example I was going to give. That was exactly an example of something. But the first time I encountered the Gemara, it was obvious to me that this was cultural, and it was only okay. The Gemara, in several places, makes an assumption that the statement itself, Tav Lemeitav Tandu Lemeitav Armalu Tov Tav is Tov Lemeitav Lashevet Tanzu two together, I mean, Lemeitav Armalu rather than alone. Better to be together than alone, which in isolation is very nice. In fact, I suggest it as a quote for our wedding invitation, as our initials are Ted and Nun. husband and we were looking for clothes. I'm like, oh, that's beautiful. However, the context, the reason my husband rejected this sensibly as a quote for a wedding invitation is because the context, several contexts in which appears in Lara, is generally making an assumption that this is true for women and not for men. In other words, it comes up in context of Lara with the assumption that women would settle, basically, because better to be together under any circumstances than to be alone. And it is always an assumption made made for women, not for men. And in fact, the Gemara contrasts that men would not necessarily come to the same conclusions. So this is exactly the example I had in mind when I was saying that when I first learned this, I remember like it being infinitely clear to me that this is cultural. And many years later, when I read Carol Gilligan's in a different voice, she has a whole analysis of modern psychology and suggests that modern psychology is all biased against women. That Freud and Kohlberg and a lot of the leading thinkers and modern developers of modern psychology, much of their studies were based all on male subjects. And therefore, women tend to deviate from the norm since the male subjects were the norm. And one of her examples, she talks about men and women and the priority of relationship between men and women. And I just remember there was one sentence when I was reading the book, and I read the sentence and I said, she's arguing to help the Maid of Tanzu and the Maid of Ivarlou. And I wasn't necessarily more convinced by it when she said it than I was by Chazal, but I was more open to it when she said it. As and she was arguing that it was something deeply rooted in female psychology. So it was something which really made me rethink my knee-jerk assumption that Chazal were, only. I would certainly agree that they were, would have to be influenced by the surrounding culture, but that they were everything they say is a reflection of the surrounding culture. That really made me rethink it very significantly.
Very true. The other thing also that I want to add is I'm not sure that culture has always changed, meaning if Chazal were in Eretz HaTzvi or in Lindenbaum, they would probably have said different things. But, the teachers who I grew up with, again, totally would still say the, and I think it's important to realize, because this is actually one piece of my biography that I left out, it wasn't like suddenly I went to that summer in Drisha and then everything was like, well, Gemara is awesome and it's totally, open to women. Meaning, I actually, a few years after I was already learning Gemara in a serious way, and it was already a serious part of my life, I ran into a teacher of mine who I'd had in 12th grade, who I'd been very close with. We ran into each other at a wedding, and we spent the entire wedding, probably 4 or 5 hours, outside, because she was talking to me, meaning she was seriously concerned that I was going off the derech with this whole Gemara thing. And I have to say, it really threw me. For, I would say, a few months after that wedding, I was like, I don't know, maybe I should, switch derech. It really threw me. But the point is that I think that because we're probably most of us all coming from a certain world, I think that we almost forget that a huge part of, even the, relatively modern Orthodox population, even in Maya, no, it's still controversial, even in Teaneck. Meaning the culture hasn't totally changed, and our little corner of the world has changed, but it's not changed everywhere.
Do you think that it's controversial because it really is controversial and it really, the girls, for example, feel that it is problematic, or is it because that's the way girls have been educated for many, 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 many hundreds of years. That is controversial. That is problematic. Do you understand what I'm saying? In other words, you're saying it's still controversial. Why is it still controversial? Is it still controversial? Because that has been continued to be education in a large segment of the community that is controversial.
Right. Meaning so many people are still against it.
Or is there this acceptance of it as controversial? Is a question of where did it come from? Did it come from the education, or did it come from some objective reason why it's controversial?
I mean, in the case of women learning Gemara, there are statements in the Gemara that are.
No, I understand.
Yeah, but in any case, but there definitely are many people who are still opposed to it.
No question.
Yeah.
Yes.
For many of us, women learning might almost be taken for granted, but I think the real contentious issue today is women in more leadership positions. So what do you think about women taking a role in Jewish leadership?
First of all, I, you know, having been in a position of leadership, I, you know, it's a question whether women are really not taking leadership roles and whether that's problematic.
Specifically, things like the many different titles that have been thrown around, like there was the whole thing with Rabbi Weiss and Rabbah and things with like Maharad and Yoetzet, so specifically pertaining to those types of things.
So in other words, only certain types of leadership.
Yeah.
And then you'd have to explain why those types of leaderships are problematic as opposed to others, because there are many places in which women can take a position of leadership because they can't speak publicly, etc. They can't take the positions of leadership in a co-ed environment. So the question is, you know, where is that distinction? Why is that distinction made? Where is that distinction made? And what is it based on? And I think you had a share about that earlier today, right? So I'm not going to
Yeah, I just think a lot of these questions also have to deal with just larger issues of just also like how do we think that halakha changes? Meaning in many of these instances, like I would imagine probably when what you learned today about Rabbah is that in many of the instances there are not strong halakhic impediments. I mean, from a strict in a vacuum, just a straight reading of the sources, would in many of the cases it would be fine. And then it's just a question of doing it in a way that the community is ready for it and is open to hearing it and open to accepting it. And I think it's more a question of a smart way to go about it, more than a question of whether it can be done. I almost think it's more a question about, like, what's the community ready for?
I'm just going to throw in an anecdote. When we started JLI, so we were officially sponsored by the OU, which didn't mean very much in practice, except that they happened to be the ones who were writing our paychecks. So that was important to us. So there was some negotiation. It's like the financial negotiation was we had negotiated a financial package. And then afterwards, it was almost like an afterthought, like how much would we each get, but we had negotiated a total package. Rabbi Menachem Schrader, who's the one who hired us, was quite adamant. He actually wanted it to be 50-50, wanted to be clear that we were both equal members of this project. And when he went to the OU, he was just working out the details with the OU, he said whatever we had come to, whatever financial agreement we had come to, and the person in charge at the OU said, "You're paying the Rebbetzin." I was totally perplexed that I was going to have any salary. And it wasn't going to matter, Lamasa, right? It wasn't going to have, in Israel it would matter in terms of taxation, but in Chutz La'aretz you file joint taxes, so it wasn't going to matter, Lamasa, if one of us had the whole salary or we split it 50-50 or 30-70. Lamasa, it didn't affect us. But again, Rabbi Schrader, who hired us, for him it was very important in principle that we both be acknowledged. I don't remember who it was. It doesn't embed better that way. At the OU, was totally dumbfounded that the Rebbetzin was going to be paid. And Rabbi Schrader was quite adamant. And 2 years later, when we were at the OU conference, the then head of the OU, who had taken over in the interim, proudly introduced this new program called Jewish Leadership on Campus. And one of the innovative elements of this program is that both members of the couple are employed officially by the OU and are paid by the OU. And my husband kind of nudged me and said, "I think you became the first Orthodox rabbi." So I think that that's, I can tell you from friends of mine, various other stories along those lines. So I think that's what Mrs. Krauss was getting at, that there's a world of opportunities that have become open to women in terms of leadership. So I think that the hang-up on the title was a setback in a certain way. I think there were many opportunities that were being opened, and in this very quiet, subtle, non-controversial way, women were starting to do everything. And the focus on the title, I really think, created this explosion of bad publicity, which I really felt was a tremendous... I have a tremendous amount of respect for Rabbi Weiss, but I thought this was a tremendous setback.
Yeah, I agree, and that's what I mean by like what the community is ready for. I think the title thing, the community, it was no different. She had actually, I had lived in Riverdale, she had actually been doing exactly, like nothing changed in her role, but the community was not ready for the title, and I agree, I think it was a setback. I think it wasn't smart to push it where the community wasn't ready to go.
I just want to, if you don't mind, I just want to react to that. I understand, of course, and I agree that it was probably, not probably, I think it was not a good idea at that particular time. However, this constant reference to of what the community is ready for can become really problematic. I've been around for seeing this develop for the last 40 years, and what the community is ready for sometimes has to be pushed, just as it was pushed in your case, Naomi, so that one has to be very careful about how much damage is done, the cost-damage ratio. But I think that, and I have to give credit to those people who have been pushing the envelope, and sometimes we violently disagree with them about pushing the envelope. And I give you a very good example of where, for example, in the Aguna situation, I think things that have happened, and that's something that has to be addressed, I think the pushing has been extremely important. So there's to be a careful balance between the two, and sometimes the disagreement is healthy.
And sorry, just one last point is I almost think to a large extent the question almost would go back to all of you, meaning I think what a lot will determine it is at the point in time where men feel ready to have a woman be their rabbi or be their leader, I think that's when it will happen. I almost think it's not a test, it's almost more like on your shoulders.
Why did the study of Gemara is such a focal point? Especially Mrs. Noy, you mentioned a lot that the study of Gemara is kind of like the break between the Haredi world and
I totally think so. I'll tell you, because access to knowledge is everything. It's ironic to me that, say, now, for example, with like the whole question about women getting aliyot, and one of the arguments that I've often heard made is this like slippery slope argument. And I always sort of feel like for those who are against women learning Gemara, that's like a legitimate argument. But if you're pro women learning Gemara, then you can't argue slippery slope about women getting aliyot, because that was exactly the argument made against women learning Gemara was, well, if they learn Gemara, then they're going to want to be rabbis. And if they learn Gemara, they're going to want to do like all these things. And they were right. The only question, which is exactly what Nir says, is, well, do you think the slope is going up or down? Meaning, like, the question is, do you think that these things, meaning women rabbis, women becoming yotzot halakha and helping women in Hilchot Nidah and things like that, do you think that that's like a step forward or a step backwards? But the point is that, in my mind, it all starts with Gemara, because if you don't have access to knowledge, then of course you can't be a rabbi. Like, there could never be a havamina to be a rabbi if you can't even learn a page of Gemara. Same thing with being a yotzot halakha. Of course you can't, like, have any, like, you can never even, like, take the first step towards helping women in Hilchot Nidah if you can't learn the sugya. Everything. I really, like, and I think that's true in all of life. Which is the same reason why, like, I'm pro-college and pro-graduate school and pro-meaning. Like, it's in everything. It's not just in Torah. Like, it's always true. Education is, like, whatever. It gives you access to everything. So it's definitely true, I think, in Torah as well.
Well said.
So in Saul Berman's article on Women in Halacha, he posits that the reason why there's such an emphasis on tzniut might be, in regards to women, is because they don't have the same physical reminders that men have, like tefillin or tzitzit or kippah. So I was wondering if in your experience, in your learning experience, did you ever find that tzniut was overemphasized, or maybe in Beis Yaakov, for example, did you feel that it was used to distract from other issues, just to focus on this one issue and kind of hide other things?
So I have many thoughts on the tzniut topic. I'm glad that you raised it, only because it bothers me that I think that what has happened is that because prior to, say, women having access to learning, there sort of was no other way for a woman to show that she was frum, or for her to express her frumkai even to herself, other than by dressing in a tznius way. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, there wasn't minyan, there's not tefillin, there's not learning. Like, there just, that was it. So tznius became like the end all be all defining everything of like a frum woman. But, and so that I think is bad, meaning I'm happy to be part of a world where like women can also have access to all these other things. But at the same time, I'm so disturbed by the fact that I feel that our world a little bit has taken it to the opposite extreme of saying because a woman can express herself by learning and doing mitzvot and like all these things, that therefore tznius was like oppressive or whatever it is, and therefore we can like chuck it out the window and like only define ourselves through these other things and like ignore tznius. Like I very much believe that like tznius is still an important part of being a Jewish woman. It's just it's not the only part, but I almost think that to a certain extent, like our world often has said that since we don't want it to be the only part, we went to the opposite extreme and like tried to sort of almost like get rid of it. And I think it's an important part. It's just an important part together with many other things. It's not the only thing, but it's important as well, I think.
I'd like to address that. First, I think that, if I remember correctly, that Saul Berman says that women took on the aspect of tznius upon themselves because they didn't have these other ways of externally, if I remember correctly. But I want to say that I have a different point of view. I think that seeing it and has become associated with women. And I think that it has completely distorted the meaning of tzniut. I think that hatznei alechet and Hashem alokecha has nothing to do with the length of the sleeves or the length of the skirt. So I think that is really, really problematic. I think it's problematic both for women and for men. I'll tell you, I had actually an incident in my school where I was asked to speak about tznius, which I don't like to speak about, but I agreed, and I decided that I'm going to speak to my students and sort of see where they're coming from. And I remember I went into an 11th grade class, and I asked the girls, you know, what they feel about tznius. And one of them said, and she was a particularly outgoing, lively young woman. She lives in Israel now, and she's, you know, she's a great, really frum woman. And she said, I don't think it's fair. I think that guys are encouraged to be chevroman and to, you know, to be out there and to be extroverted, etc. And if we do the same thing, it's not sanua. That was one incident. Another incident is where one girl got up at an assembly and said, somebody asked, what is the message you get from tznius? And she said, the message I get from tznius is just disappear. So I think that the overemphasis on tznius, and particularly on tznius for women, and particularly on the way they look externally, and how they dress, A, is very damaging to women. It's damaging to them, I think, emotionally, psychologically, etc. It's damaging in the way they're viewed. And it's also damaging in terms of very often turning them off from the important things in Judaism. I would much rather see an emphasis on learning and an emphasis on chesed for men and for women than on how they are dressed. That being said, I think that tznius is a very important value, but it has to be put into perspective.
I adamantly agree with that. Two things, though, I just wanted to add. One is, Dean and I both teach a course in Hishavah and Mitzvot at Lindenbaum, and when we talk about these topics, I really do try to frame it, as Mrs. Krauss did, and try to emphasize, I always try to emphasize that we're usually looking at a select passage in the Gemara, which comes in a bigger context, and we're looking at the passage that deals with women, because I'm teaching a group of women about their obligations, but that there are often more passages that men are dealing with. Probably the most central passage we learn is the Gemara in Brachot that deals with Tefach Isha Erva and Se'ar B'Isha Erva, and sort of lists what's considered nakedness for women. And I always try to emphasize to the students that the way most of the Rishonim read it is that these three things are emphasized because these are unique. These are the only three things that are unique. In other words, that erva is a universal concept, and these are the three things that are in three areas in which there's a difference in the halacha between men and women. And the students often respond appropriately, well, if what you're saying is true, how come none of our male friends are being told anything about tznius? If it's a universal concept, why are we the only ones talking about it? So this is definitely something which I think is chaser, not in women's education, but chaser in men's education. And I, again, like Dina said, in terms of the rabbi issue, I think that there is a tremendous gap that has developed
in the past couple of decades between men's education and women's education in, as Dina said, our small corner of the Jewish community. And I think at this point there's more work to be done with men's education than women's education in order to help like women's education. Filling in the gap is even more critical. On the other hand, when we structure the class in Women Halacha, I am very adamant. The first thing we talk about is women in Talmud Torah and women in Tefillah and Berakhat HaMazon and most of what Rav Aviah dealt with this morning. And the students are often very impatient to get to the stuff we put at the end, which is Kalisha and Kisoy Rosh, etc. And then when we get there, they say, how come this is all that everyone talks to us as women about? And I try to make them aware of the fact that we sort of bring it upon ourselves and that we should be focusing more on the areas where we can express ourselves very positively as halachic Jews. The third point I want to make, which is something which I've only those of you who have met our family, so you know we have a lot of daughters, Leah and Hara, and Sophie over here, is our first son. I have now had this like recent epiphany when Sophie hit three. It occurred to me that there is definitely an asymmetry in the way I like think about these issues. You know, you had posted in terms of like the outward signs of being Jewish, somehow, how graphic should I be? I realized. So for a second, a friend of mine, her son's Hanachat Tefillin, her younger daughter, said, Ima, when I'm a bat mitzvah, are we going to have a hanachat mitpachat? and it was interesting that from her five-year-old perspective, these were both positive symbols of being Jewish, and that was her positive symbol of being Jewish, which is, I have to admit, not the way I've looked at it all my life. But maybe there is an asymmetry also in the education that we've received and that we give, in that tzitzit, and this is what I learned from Svi, tzitzit for a three-year-old can certainly be a huge burden, tzitzit and kippah, but we frame it as such a privilege that I think they quickly learn to not see it as a burden. And I'm not capable of convincing my daughters yet, but maybe they will be, that they have positive symbols.
Can I ask a question? I know you mentioned this idea of the immediate issue about each other. I was wondering if you see it as an ideal that only women should be teaching women, and at the same time, is there an ideal that one day women should be teaching men? Let's say Yeshiva like ours. Would that be something that you would see as something important that should happen in the Jewish world? So I'm asking on both.
I see you're not in charge of recruitment.
I don't know if that means time. I think it would require a huge, huge change in progress in the entire perspective of the Jewish community before one can even entertain that question. I can look at it in a very theoretical way. One of the things that I'm just going to backtrack for a second. One of the important things that I was aiming for when we opened Maya Note was that we would have a male Tanakh teacher and a female Halach Gemara teacher. It ended up that Rabbi Helfgott became the department chair of Tanakh, and Mrs. Mayer, Sally Mayer, became the department chair of Talmud. That role modeling is extremely important, and the perspective that we were talking about before is extremely important. And I think that guys do miss out. And not only do they miss out, but I think the Jewish community misses out by the fact that men are educated only solely by men in the realm of these very, very important issues. But I can't see it happening in the very near future. It's only beginning to happen in high schools, in co-ed high schools. And even there, there's a tremendous reluctance to allow a woman.
Are there today, I don't know, fresh places like that?
High School do.
They have one teaching Gemara.
Gemara.
No, Ramaz.
Well, they're coincident.
Maybe Ramaz does not. I'm not sure about that.
Ramaz does not. I think it did. I think it did.
Right. No, Ramaz. They might not have had this. In principle, I know they at some point were actively speaking. I think they may have had this.
And Adrian is one
here. SAR, on someone's application this year from SAR, they had, we asked for, recommenders, and they put down relationships. So one, this, that, one male was a teacher, and then a particular female is a rabbi. So I wrote her asking about this particular student.
It's also an interesting thing, forgetting even just from the teacher perspective. Overall, I'm not pro co-ed education for many reasons, but for this one reason is the one reason why I almost think it's chaval that I can't be pro it for other reasons. Meaning, I really do feel that no matter how much we can tell you, oh, women are smart too, women can learn too, unless you're actually learning side by side, either from a woman or learning side by side with a woman and in the same class and getting the same grades and whatever it is, I think the guys won't really believe it. And honestly, I think the girls won't really believe it. I think even the girls, will always have a sense of the boys must be doing more different or something, So for that reason, I think it's an important thing sort of to go co-ed, although again, for other factors that I think beat out this one, I'm not pro it, but it's sort of cabal.
This question might make some of the things that some of my friends who are at various shows. But to what extent, we're opening up women's learning for everyone, really encouraging that. But what about women's tefillah? It's a totally different form of Avodah Hashem. And in yeshiva, those are the two new ones, tefillah and Talmud Torah. And I'm just, my conversations with my friends, I'm feeling like they do a lot more Talmud Torah than tefillah. Is the solution to this to say, okay, fine, all women should be learning, should be davening three times a day in a minyan? Or, should we be emphasis on that for...
I'll start only to say that not that I have any solutions, but you've hit upon probably the issue I'm most obsessive about. I think that you're correct, because I have so much exposure to what's going on in a men's yeshiva versus a women's madrashah, I see it and it really pains me. I think it's very lacking the tefillah community that you can have in the yeshiva environment. I think that I do not know of anyone who has any real solutions to this. I actively seek ideas on this often. It's a real tension. One time I had a group of students. I often debate, even on the level of when I have a Shabbat Ramen at my house, Friday night, should we go to shul or should we daven in the house so we can have a Kabbalah Shabbat? Just because I think it's an opportunity, not because I'm trying to push women's tefillah per se, but because of the creating a group tefillah goes along with our learning community that we're also a davening community. The students are often uncomfortable with it, especially the students who went to co-ed schools. I once had a group of students and I gave them a choice, and it was around 20 students, and they were split down the middle, and I realized afterwards that every student who had gone to a co-ed high school was against having a woman's tefillah, and every student who had been in single-sex high school wanted it. The students, it's a positive thing. The students who have gone to a co-ed school have been trained to see minyan as normative tefillah, so if there's a minyan option, why shouldn't they take it? I'm only enforcing your question. I don't have any answers, but I think that you're on to something which is really lacking. But I do think that creating a kind of, there's a drawback to both. There's a drawback to creating a separatist woman's tefillah, I think. But there's a drawback to always having to rely on local minyanim wherever you go.
Thank you very much.
It is hard, but honestly, it's a challenge both ways. But at the same time, I would think that minyan is in some ways a real positive force, meaning to have this sort of like tefillah community together. But at the same time, it's probably also a real challenge to get people to wake up and come to minyan. So in that way, can't say I have any. So I'm just saying, like, in that way, that's why I would imagine that we don't. I think there's two reasons probably why we don't push it so much. One is simply that, like, I feel like there are enough things that we're struggling with, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, so why sort of like push when that's going to be such a hard challenge that we don't have to? The other thing is, I don't know whether you were asking about women's tefillah as opposed to going to a men's minyan, or if you were asking about women's tefillah as a group as opposed to each girl davening on her own in her
I
own room.
I wasn't.
Oh, so what were you asking? Did we misunderstand our question?
No, I was inspired by just
kind of
thinking about how difficult it was today for me to get out of bed and get a minyan. Like, I did it, and the fact that I did it, like, made me a better person.
Yeah, no,
I would also add this is more as a mother of daughters than as a teacher. I think that the tefillah education is a much more complex message. Do I wake up my daughters on the Shabbat that I'm not going to shul because I'm home with younger children? And the truth is, and education, you know, we hope is education for life, and it's a much more realistically, you will all be in different situations, and minyan will be harder or easier at different points in your life. But the message is very clear that you should daven with minyan for the rest of your life every day. Whereas that is not my message to my students, and it's a very complex message. Am I trying to educate them for the next 3, 4, 5 years of their lives? Am I trying to educate them for the next 20 years of their life, in which I know that I went through, and my husband can testify, a very, very, I would say, painful experience of sort of feeling that I lost tefillah because I was someone who did daven with the minyan regularly, and then when it was no longer so realistic for me to daven with the minyan, and I had to sort of relearn how to daven. So I don't know, like, if our education should sort of incorporate that there are different paradigms for tefillah. So I think it's much more complex, and I think that's part of the tension in trying to figure out what. I don't know, there was an article after the first Jofa, it wasn't even called Jofa yet, but after the first Jofa conference, I remember there was an article attacking the conference that my husband made the mistake of showing me. In the article, it was like a 4-page article. Sti wrote me nebri throughout the article about tefillah, where there was a footnote in the article that said, obviously, the ideal is behind halachas mechitza and halachas minyan. And then later, the article talked about chana as the ideal and solitary tefillah as the ideal. And it just so highlighted for me how much, in so much of the dialogue in the past number of years about women's tefillah, I don't think that those who are against innovations have put in the time and energy to say, so what do we think is the ideal? And I don't think there really is a parent. And maybe that's because there can't be one.
Mm-hmm. I just want to support one of the things that Naomi said. I grew up in Besiaka, and at Besiaka we davened every morning. I did not daven on Shabbos and Sunday. It was not, you know. We daven because I had to go to class. I had to go to daven. You know, that was just the way it was. When we were married and I became a Rebbetzin, and I didn't get paid extra, I went to shul. I started going to shul, and it became I cannot not go to shul on Shabbos morning and daven. My Shabbos is not a Shabbos. And sometimes it's very hard and sometimes I'm very tired. But it really became much, much more meaningful to me once I started going to a minyan. So it's a big problem.
Can I roll up the questions from here and
yeah, I feel like there's a lot more questions
some
here.
That is from people that asked. So we go last, of course. I'm rolling into a number of connecting it to something that you said. Earlier you said it seemed like some of you were saying in terms of limits, in terms of simply slope and things along those lines. Are there no limits whatsoever? And is there no end to that? Pizza, non-pizza, things like that, or even further than that. And I guess on the same vein, is there no super or extra halachic considerations that you seem to, I don't know, brush those aside, but in technical terms it's okay, but and then it's just a matter of time before it therefore also becomes okay? Are those considerations not considerations? Okay, we'll have a couple of questions.
Yeah, she was just suggesting maybe to hear all the questions and then maybe we could try that. I mean, again, it could be they'll be totally unrelated.
Right, so
but
I rolled
up
a few. So
okay, good, yeah. I don't know, just go around the room, I guess. Yeah, we'll go around.
So, one discussion this Shabbat, it's on the subject of sneer. This Shabbat, on Friday night, we were discussing how in the Maccabees New Purim video, they have the role of Esther is played by this little baby girl.
That's very cute.
Yeah, but one of the issues is, one of the, that was talking about it was saying that it's a problem that there's such an issue of censorship online for, who you're trying to please when you post a video like that. What do you think the limits should be for that? And do you think maybe somebody who would have a problem with a real woman actually playing that role, do you think they should just not be on YouTube?
Well, that's to say, that could have just been I'm guessing it was one of their music or something, and they just thought it was funny. I mean, I didn't actually think that there was anything deeper. I mean, I could be wrong, but I really just thought it was probably that they thought
it
was funny.
Our conversation led to the fact that it seemed they refused to have an actual woman. And
interesting.
I
did not take it that way, but you could be right. I have no idea. I don't know anything.
So if I'm just on the level of censorship on Jewish censorship, what do you think the limit should be now that the role of women has changed?
Okay, we got it. Yeah, what else?
So this is might seem a little bit radical, maybe not, we'll find out. So we've talked about the cultural differences between then and now. And the reason why, or at least it seems to me, that, for example, the Talmud had these certain halachot or said these certain things is because of the cultural time in which they lived. So nowadays, when roles are different and the cultural roles of women are different, and so you would say, okay, so let's do different things first, right? Mechitza, not mechitza, whatever. But my question is for the men's side. Let's say if the men are occupying different roles, meaning, let's say if the woman now is the one who's going out to work, does that mean that she's the one that doesn't have, that has to do mitzvah the seh shazman gerama, but the man who's, let's say, the male of the household staying at home, should he be patur? Should everything be flipped then if the roles are flipped?
And that relates to this question.
If the questioning parts, if your questions can be short questions so they have time to have the answers, then that would be helpful. Go ahead, go.
We're taking all the questions.
They're taking
all
the questions and trying to see what they can answer.
You only have a few minutes.
So do you think there's value? Do you think there's value in women performing all the various mitzvot, like tefillah, that are there questionable halachic obligations, whether they should, can, done once a day, twice a day? There's obviously a large section of women who do take it upon themselves to go to minyan three times a day, et cetera, et cetera. Do you think there's value in that? In that, halachically, psychologically, as a front for the Jewish community to see that there are women who do that, and if so, why?
What do you feel the effect of the growing liberalism and feminism in other areas of Judaism, especially conservatism and reformism, has had an effect on the growth of women in leadership positions within Orthodox Judaism?
From a male perspective, you can't see me, but
yeah.
I think it's easier for people to get the slippery slope argument because it isn't clear what the goal is. Like, it isn't always clear, what the intent of, normalizing, let's say, a woman's tefillah, things like that. It isn't clear if it's sort of pushing for a baseline halakhic observance for women that is more interactive or more applied. I don't know really how to describe it. Or if it's something along the lines of, it sometimes seems like there isn't a clear goal that can be logicized and explained, and it's difficult to understand from the male perspective exactly where things are supposed to be headed. And so, when I see pushing the envelope, I'd love to see where it's being pushed, and I'd love to see where it's going, but it's very difficult to get that when it doesn't seem like everybody pushing the envelope knows exactly where they're pushing towards. And, a little bit of a concern, but I'd just like to know what you guys individually think what the goal should be.
Do you think it's possible that perhaps society in regards to Judaism and women in a lot of modern Orthodox communities hasn't changed not because the world and the men aren't ready for it, but because in so many of the communities, especially where I grew up, the majority of the women don't want it. And they're quite happy with the status quo. And in fact, they don't want to have all these things to be responsible for. And it's not that the men aren't ready and the communities aren't ready.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, so you want to No one wants to squeeze in if that's the only other one.
Are you insulted by Shalom Sunny and Michelle?
Short and sweet.
Are you insulted by it?
I'll start with that one. I'm very insulted by it. And therefore, I made a decision that I make it my business to come to shul on time, but after Shalom Sani Isha. I think that I'm one of the reasons that I'm really happy that we made Aliyah among many, many others is the fact that they don't say the brachot in shul here. So I can come on time and there's no problem.
That's why we have the policy here.
I think that there is a concept of lo'eg l'rosh. The concept of... Pardon me? I say there is a concept of lo'eg l'rosh. In other words, that you sort of are making fun of a poor person. For example, you shouldn't be davening in front of a kever because a person can't do the mitzvot. I think that that could be transferred as well to lower sanitation. I'm just thinking about... I'm going to address the question and we won't... I won't do all the questions, certainly, neither will any of us. I address the question of are there no meta-halachic limits, right? Much of what is termed halacha is... Much of it is policy statements and policy decisions. And personally, I'm going to be very brief. Personally, I think that it is time that... And this will take time, but with the growth of women's learning, I think it is extremely important that women become involved in halachic discourse and in interpreting halacha. And I think that the concept of no taxation without representation, I think that it's very problematic that these policy decisions are made by men who can't experience a lot of the things that women do, and have different perspectives. And I think that it's the commitment to halakha remain. That's the limit is the commitment to halakha. Beyond that, it's where you go with all of the different factors. And certainly, in terms of policy decisions need to be made based on who they're being made for. And half of the population is female. I'll rest there.
Okay, I'll try to hit on whatever I can. In terms of the first one about limits, so first of all, there are limits just because there are certain actual halakhot. Like, regarding many of the questions that come up, like women being rabbis, women getting aliyot, things like that, people's knee-jerk reaction is that, oh, it must be usser, when in fact there's really tons of room for perhaps saying it's mutter. But on the other hand, there are many things, like women counting towards a minyan, that, I just don't think there's any way around it. Like, we just don't count. So in terms of are there limits, there are limits that I think there just is no
like, and that's it. Like, there are, and there's a bunch of things like that. That's not the only one. So there definitely are limits. There are things that I think just can't change because the halacha just is X. In terms of meta-halacha considerations, there definitely are those, but that, and that actually also goes towards the slippery slope question that was from the back over there, is there are definitely meta-halacha considerations, but that is where there is room, meaning in terms of there are limits where there are certain, like halacha is X, and so women just can't count for a minyan. But in terms of all these questions about, like, do we want there to be women rabbis? Do we think it's a positive thing, the fact that women are now going out and having careers and that the roles have been changing? It also actually relates to the question about men's role, meaning in the fact that men are also doing more of the child-rearing. Like, all that, those types of questions about, like, does halacha view this as, like, a positive move? That people can argue both ways, meaning you can totally bring arguments from Tanakh and things like that, that, like, God must have intended women's role to be X. But I don't think that when it comes to those types of things, I think the argument could go either way. I don't think it's clear. And that's also, again, that's the whole slippery slope thing, meaning do we view it as women starting to learn Gemara was a slippery slope towards women wanting to be rabbis, or do we view it as women learning Gemara was this, like, fantastic opening of the door so that now we can have women leaders so that instead of losing 50% of, like, Jewish talent, we're now getting 50% of our voices back and 50% more people, you know, who are learning and have opportunities to become somebody chachamim and opportunities to be leaders and role models and whatever else. When it comes to all those things, but again, one could definitely argue that it's a positive thing to have women more involved and everything like that, but I definitely could hear somebody arguing the exact opposite and bring sources and Tanakh and all, and just sociologically why it wouldn't be a good thing for the Jewish community. So there, I think it's whatever, the argument could go either way. But in terms of the question about the men's role actually from a technical perspective, that I just think it can change. The same way as the halacha is X, that women don't count towards a minyan, so the halacha is Y, that a man is the one who is obligated to be the one who puts on the tefillin and attends the minyan and whatever it is. So even if it happens to be that in an individual family, their roles are somewhat reversed in terms of how they live their lives, the same way as the halacha can't change and a woman can't start counting towards a minyan, it's just that's what the halacha is. So too, I don't think that just because of an individual family makes a personal decision about their roles, I mean, whatever, the halacha is the halacha, so I don't think it should change.
Can I throw one more thing there?
Oh, sure.
How does that make you feel?
Oh, that's nice.
Okay, you're like, okay, that's it, I have
one. Right, so
this is saying that there are limits, and whatever limits there are.
It's interesting that it's an important question. And the truth is, I'm almost surprised always by the fact that I'm not so bothered by it. I feel like I should be, but, like, I don't know if it's related to our answer before about the fact that the truth is, I also, before I had kids, used to go to Minyan, but again, like, once you have kids, it's just not practical, and I'm not upset about that. Like, I actually, like, I want to be the primary caretaker. Like, I don't want to change that. So, but the fact that I don't want to change that doesn't mean that other women might not, and so the fact that I'm not upset about it doesn't mean that nobody else has their right to. So, personally, I'm not so upset by it, but doesn't mean that other women aren't, and I think they have a right to be. In terms of, oh, also the question, also there was one from the back about the fact that it's maybe not the community and men who aren't ready, it's the women. It crushes me, and I wish that weren't true, but he's totally right. But I have to say, when I said the community isn't ready, I also did mean the women. He's totally right. I thought that once Stern opened a Gemara, you know, a program to train women in learning Gemara, that the floodgates would open, and now it's under Stern, and it's a very, like, it's not a controversial place, and it's very accepted, and whatever it is. And it's just, it's not. Like, you're right. So I still think that we need to make the opportunities available for those women who you see in front of you right now, who do want these opportunities and who do want to be able to learn and things like that. But it's the same thing, by the way, with women rabbis. I think that it won't happen for a long time, not just because, you're right, not just because the men aren't ready. How many women are looking for it? I don't know if there's
probably
enough.
Probably more than we would think.
It could be.
In terms of wanting to contribute to the community in a certain way. And that I think that, you know, the definition of rabbi is open to question.
Correct, that is true. But it upsets me about the Gemara thing. I wish there were more.
Can I just add one quick thing, and then I don't want to take your time away. I just want to mention one thing, and that is, you're saying that how many women, for example, want to come to the learning. When a boy is born, and at the bris, from the time of the bris, he is told that the most important thing that you need to do in life is to learn Torah. Okay, I think that that's a message that girls, not only don't they get the message, but they have to learn in 10th grade a unit on whether it's defensive, whether they have to defend their right to learn Gemara. So why would you expect that there would be a large outpouring of women who suddenly want to do this? And the community is still questioning it. It's still controversial. Mm-hmm. So I think it's unfair to say that the women are not ready for it. I think that there's a lot that goes with nurture and training. Mm-hmm. Naomi.
I'll start with that. When I use the phrase "the community is not ready," I meant men and women. Community to me does mean by definition men and women, so that's what I meant. And 100%. And I've seen this a few different contexts, both in our community at Frost as well as at Brandeis community. There were a few opportunities where we actually pulled the community in certain issues, and we saw it very much that. Certain issues in terms of tefillah and inclusivity of women in tefillah, and we saw it was very split amongst the men and very split amongst the women. Equal, pretty much equal numbers, which was shocking to me, but I've seen it a few times now. I don't know if I would frame it the way whoever asked the question way back there, I can't see, is that women don't want to take on responsibility. I think it comes from not shying away from responsibility, but a lack of feeling of loss or need. That's just not like women. I think there are a lot of women who are. I also, when I started learning post college at Stern, did not have a program then. I learned at Linderman, and there were three such programs for graduates, women. Two have closed, one has lowered its standards, I think, significantly since that time. And I have often distressed by feeling that we're moving backwards. But I think it's important to keep in mind that there are other, that as much as for me and as Dean expressed, Talmud Torah is so defining, but I think the critical need is what Dean said earlier. I still remember the end of the year, one of my teachers at Linderman giving a sicha, final sicha of the year, that was really a life-changing sicha for me, where he talked about the Jewish community not being able to afford to lose 50% of its resources, and that really was really a sicha that just stuck with me and kept reverberating and really sent me really on a path. But I think that can take many outlets, and I don't think that women who are sort of in the forefront in certain areas should be closed to women finding outlets. The critical thing, I guess this also relates to the slippery slope question, sort of what I consider my sort of the paradigm happens to be the Sfida Eishes Tshuva on Kol Isha. I always look to that Tshuva as a paradigm, not per se for the Kol Isha part, although I think it's important for what he says about Kol Isha. But when he's asked about women, men and women singing Zmirot together, whether that's a Kol Isha issue, and just the methodology and how he answers the question. First, he goes through the Makarot to basically justify, find sources which would justify women participating in public singing. But he doesn't stop there. He then goes on to say, what is the motivation? Why is he going to choose this position? Which he acknowledges at the outset is from a strictly, and what Dean is talking about, from a strictly textual basis, he feels is actually the weaker argument. But nonetheless, it's the one he's going to adopt. So he talks about why, and he talks about Eit Laso Hashem, a time to do for God. And I always think that that's really a paradigm in terms of these slippery slope questions. The question I always think you have to ask is, is this Eit Laso Hashem? Is this going to further Avodah Hashem in the world? Right? And in terms of the question of men's responsibility, besides saying, I'm talking very quickly now, trying to get it all in, besides what Dina said, that there are just halachic limits, and we can't say men are not going to have certain obligations. and women are, but I also don't think that's what we're striving for. We're not striving to switch roles. We're striving at anything much as what feminism has responded to in the 20th century, is that the world has changed such that the levels of responsibility of housekeeping and child care have changed, such that we could share without taking away from men's ability. In Avodah Hashem, the point is, I think, that there's more opportunity for more people collectively to be involved actively in other channels of Avodah Hashem, and that's what I think always has to be sort of the critical have in mind in terms of the slippery slope. Is this going to be increasing the Avodah Hashem in the world? You know, which is, I guess, very broad terms to speak in, but for me, that's sort of like the guiding question relates to the slippery slope issue. And this last thing, but I definitely think, by the way, of course there's value in a woman going to Minyan, sitting in a sukkah, learning Torah, whatever, just because somebody had asked, I think, right, was it you who said? Somebody asked, is there value in women doing those things? Like, I think there's some who say not because it's not their role, but I think, of course, like, Gadol HaMitzvah says, so a man who's commanded might get more reward, but, like, I definitely think women should strive to do as much as we can within what we can.
Give you an opportunity to answer any questions that weren't asked, but maybe just last final comments.
Sure, hold up.
Does he want to? I have so many questions because I'm in the middle.
I know.
Do you want us to talk about that? I actually just, right before I came, actually finished putting together a thing on that. So I actually have done like tons and tons of research into that I literally was just working on, like literally before I came. Basically, I think that is a perfect example of where I am totally convinced that this side arguing that there is room for women to get aliyot is much stronger, I think, than the side which argues that they can't. And in fact, it's almost like when you read the articles argue that they can't, to me, it sounds like they're the ones who are like grasping for straws.
Do you go?
So I do not go, but I'll tell you why not. Because that's also true. So besides for that, I think that the article that Mendel Shapiro wrote arguing for it is, I think it's like the greatest thing what he did, meaning as a layperson, and I think it's actually a great model for women also. He actually happens to have smicha, but he's not a rabbi, really. He's a lawyer. But like, I think what he showed, which is such a great model, is just because like you're a layperson who doesn't act as a rabbi, he sat down, he learned the sources, he wrote a fantastic article that is so in-depth and so learned, tons of footnotes, it's excellent, arguing for a certain case, that I think he makes a fantastic, cogent argument. The piece where I disagree, though, so I think his article is fantastic. However, I think they were wrong to act on it without Poskim behind it. Meaning, I sort of feel like that's the way that the halachic process works, is that I think it's amazing that he sort of pushed the envelope by writing the article, but we then need Poskim, like, as a Joe Schmo, like, I can't act on the fact that I happen to think it should be a good thing.
Famous rabbi would say, it's okay, you would just go, just
cut that. So, I'll tell you, so this is where I feel exactly similar to the Gemara thing. If it weren't for the fact that it was big names, meaning Ralph Slavichik and Rav Lichtenstein, who like put not just their stamp of approval, but encourage it. It's not even like they're like, all right, begrudgingly, b'dieved, okay, you can learn. They're like, women should be learning. This is a positive step forward for the Jewish community. That's why I feel comfortable with it. And personally, but again, this is just me personally, until there is somebody of at least some stature who is pushing this forward as saying, I think this is a positive step forward for the Jewish community to be, and I could see how somebody could make that argument. The same way as we argue it's positive for women to learn Gemara and whatever it is, to say it's positive to include women and make them feel part of the shul experience and everything like that. When somebody of stature will say that, then I think it's a great thing. But until somebody of stature says it, I just find it very troubling for lay people to write about it and do the learning. I think is amazing, but to act on it without a posse putting their stamp of approval, that's the piece that troubles me.
Well, without Rosh Lavishik saying, "Women can learn Gemara, you want to learn Gemara."
Yeah, I actually, to put the end of the story, so I told that story where that teacher spoke to me for like hours at that wedding. I told him for like a while after that, I was very troubled by it, and it happens to be that soon after, a few weeks after, Rav Lichtenstein came to America, and I personally, I walked 100 blocks to like go to him and personally speak to him, because I really was considering stopping. I think we need Poskim behind it. I think we need Poskim behind it.
Excuse me, can I add to that? Rav Lichtenstein at the I remember it was at the parlor meeting or at the Chanukah Abayit in Mayanot, said something to the effect that he's very important for women to learn, and But he personally feels that it could be a very, very frustrating experience because of the... And that's an interesting, interesting conflict there.
I'm curious what your... did you speak about that today?
Was
that
no, I didn't.
I'll speak for you in a second. I know Dina, I don't know if it was clear enough when Dina spoke. I think when you started, you were probably not assuming that you were going to come out of learning thinking Shira HaDashah was a positive thing. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yeah. No, totally. When I started researching the Shira HaDashah, I thought for sure. The same thing as, like, people assume about, I don't know, a lot of other things.
You just like learning it.
I totally assume for sure it's Esther. Of course it's going to be Esther. And then I really, learned it thoroughly. And I was like, whoa. I think the side arguing pro is much stronger. And I think the article's con. It really, when reading it from the source's perspective, I think they're the ones... I think often we think that the ones who are going to argue pro, they must be the ones who are looking for the esoteric sources, the obscure, whatever. They're the ones who are the Gemara says it's okay. And it's, I think, the con side who are, the ones who have to, find something to say that it's impressive. Which is why I'm a little bit surprised that a posek has not yet come out in favor of it. I don't know why
it's
not.
The same way women started learning Gemara 23 years ago, this is the same thing that's happened to you. 40, I don't know.
You mean that it's developing towards that?
That in the beginning when we started learning it was also frowned upon.
I think it's exactly similar. I think the parallels are so strong.
20 years from now, it'll be norm that women, that men and women will go, no, you don't agree.
I don't agree. I've thought about this a lot. I think that the kind of women's learning revolution, although certainly the last however many years you said it has changed, but it started Sarah Schneer, the Chavetz Chaim, that's really, everyone just built upon those, right? It really started with, so Dina would say, well, that's the point, the Chavetz Chaim was the Chavetz Chaim, and he kind of put his stamp on it early on, and that did not happen with kind of the women's tefillah revolution. I think that the language is very significant. This is one of the printed questions we never got to. The lechatchila versus bidyaved. The women, even those who like what we've seen and the Rav, who I think would say 100% lechatchila, women should be learning. They're building upon literature, which started with the language of the world has changed, and therefore we need to change. It was never ever a critique of halacha and a critique of chazal. And I think the language that has emerged around the push for change in women's tefillah has emerged as a critique of halacha. And I think that's why there is, and I think will continue to be more resistance. It didn't come out of the world has changed, so now, whether unfortunately or fortunately we're going to acknowledge that, it really came out of a critique that the halacha wasn't egalitarian. Now, whether that critique is fair or not, I'm not arguing, but as long as the language is critical, I think there's going to be a resistance to it in a very different way.
Well, see, Mendel Shapiro's article is not like that. His is much more, the times have changed, and quotes he wrote.
Neither is Rabbi Sperber.
Right.
Neither is Rabbi Sperber. Rabbi Sperber. Yeah, his arguments are certainly not couched in those points. Those and the Gemara is not the norm yet.
Well, yeah. I don't believe it. I think you're right about both of those
articles.
It's definitely
not the norm.
None of us related to the question about liberalism.
In our community,
hmm?
In our community.
Okay, but our community is only part of a much larger community. And what happens in the larger community has impact on our community. So a lot of our attitudes are formed by that community.
None of us related to the question. I don't know who asked about how much orthodoxy is affected by more liberal movements, and I think that's part of it. It could be that the particular articles are not critical, but the whole notion of changing, innovating within tefillah, I think, does come out of more liberal movements, which were critical. So I think it's hard to separate.
Yes. Isn't it all started in America?
It started in America, definitely. America is definitely in America.
The broadening of Talmud Torah versus Royal Tzvila came from a very different angle. If you think about it, broadening of Talmud Torah was never a piece of the reform movement way back in Germany. Tzvila has always been a hot button issue. Oh my gosh, you're touching Tzvila, you're reformed.
Right.
Right. You know, whereas the reformers weren't advocating, let's spread Gemara to everybody. They were get rid of the Gemara.
Right, that's an important point.
Distinction.
Thank you very, very much for...